97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
Well, we still have a lot of 9/11 memories to share here before the end of the hour. I do have something fun coming up at 5:30. So I think I've told you about Liz Camlett before. I discovered her a couple of months ago, and Keith Urban put out that Yacht Rock album, which is excellent, by the way. And the song with song with Michael and Donald is the only original on there, and it's really, really good. I noticed that Stephen Bishop's wife, her name is Liz Camlett, was doing these very interesting Instagram feeds. And the one that I first watched was where she kind of broke down how much money Stephen would make from Keith Urban covering On and On his new record. And then there's dynamics if they go to, let's say Keith comes here to, you know, Hollywood Casino Amphitheater. He plays that song. The venue has, because of licensing fees, they have to pay Stephen as well. So some of the business side of music is broken down exceptionally well by Liz. So we got in touch with her. I told Fred, I said, reach out to Liz Camlett and just tell her I'm a big fan of what she's doing on Instagram. So she's going to join us at the bottom of the hour. I'm telling you, she is fascinating. She's written a book for people. Like, if you're in the music industry and if you're young in the music industry or you want to go, you need to know the business side of the music industry.
You
it's
do.
Very important to educate yourself. And I could not think of someone better than Liz right now. And you're going to hear it when you hear that interview at the bottom of the hour. David Strom from HotAir.com is back with us this afternoon on 97.1 FM Talk. Hello, David. How are you? I think we got you on the Zoom, don't we? No, we don't. Let's see if we got him on the Zoom. There it is.
I see him.
All right. Let me see if I see him. There he is. Hello, David Strom. How are you?
I am doing really well. How's my sound?
I think it sounds okay. You guys are going to have to guide me through this. But let me start with something. We're going to do some 9/11 stuff. But you wrote a column about this, and I haven't touched this yet today. And it's just utterly ridiculous when you hear the reaction here. We found out something fascinating about the holdout juror in the Lindsey Clancy case today. And listen to Gail King's reaction.
And the other thing that I would just be remiss to not say is,
Hang on, that's the Oprah cut. I don't want that. This one's a little different. I'm sorry about that. I'm having one of those days with the buttons. Here we go.
I'm curious about the jurors themselves, because we know it was 9 women, 3 men. What was the age range? What was the racial makeup? I haven't heard any of that. What was it?
70-ish to 22.
Mm-hmm.
And one person of color, and then everybody else was white. A lot of the jurors had children.
Uh-huh. And one person of color, was a person of color a woman or a man?
A man.
A man. Is a holdout juror a person of a black man?
Yes.
A black man is a holdout juror?
Yes.
Well, I have to sit with that for just a second.
Can't really make that up, can you? That reaction. Unreal. Just shocked that it wasn't some white dude that was the holdout, right? That blew up the narrative, David Strom, didn't it?
Oh, my gosh. It was just hilarious to see that, because, of course, Gail King thinks that black people care more about minorities as victims. She's a woman, therefore she should get off. But of course, the truth is that for a lot of black people, their reaction to crime is actually, much harsher than it is for your typical wealthy woman out there who just sort of divides the world up into, the victims who fit in, they're women, minorities, trans people. Whereas if you live in a world where crime actually happens and you don't happen to be a criminal, you want criminals to be punished.
Yeah, you would think so. But, whoa, that's kind of interesting. And there's interesting reaction to that today on the social medias, isn't there? And, it's kind of interesting that Gail, you heard it in Gail's voice. I'm rather shocked that she was the first one to kind of ask that question to those jurors, because to her point, no one really knew that.
Well, you know, it's amazing that the assumption was it was a man and it was a white man, because white men in this, sort of DEI mindset are the oppressor. And of course, the way in which, the left has interpreted this is, Lindsey Clancy is the victim, not the perpetrator. They see a woman in a wheelchair and they think, oh, we have to take care of her. They're not. And, the black man, the holdout juror, said, hey, wait a second. She killed three kids. She's not the victim. She's the perpetrator.
Yeah, one of the jurors said that he couldn't get past the fact that she strangled her three children. Well, I think that's kind of a normal reaction. I think getting past the fact that three young children were strangled methodically, and again, I've been one that's expressed some empathy for the mental health aspects of this, but my goodness, it was almost like that was an afterthought for some of these jurors.
Well, and you hit on something right there. I think we can, both look at Lindsey Clancy and say she clearly needed help. She was in, deep mental distress.
Right.
And that's a real factor. And recognize she's a vicious murderer. Those two things can go together. I mean, I know plenty of people who've been in the depths of mental health crises, and you could walk into a hospital at any time and say, I think I'm a danger to myself or others, and you will get treatment. And they won't just hand you pills. It's not like we're in 1968 and it's one flew over the cuckoo's nest. There's real help out there for people, and she had certainly talked to people who could get her that help, and she decided instead to plot a murder and execute it.
Well, she was worried, justifiably so, that because of her mental condition, her children were going to be taken away from her, right? That was one of the concerns. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the civil trial, because I would make a strong case that some of the earlier testimony in the trial, there were a lot of people, and you've heard this from Kevin Reddington, that he preys on Lindsey Clancy as a mother, as a person. Well, that narrative is going to have to hold for the, the civil trials. And I'm not trying to be cynical. I'm just trying to state the facts here, because you can't have a drug company that's going to be held liable if the mother is actually liable. So it's going to be interesting. This is not over yet. I'll be very curious to see if they cut a deal or if something else happens here with this case in the future. But let's talk about 9/11, because you even pointed this out in your column today. And I missed this. I'll be honest with you, David Strom, that if you look at the New York Times today, here's a couple of headlines from 9/11, one of the worst days in our nation's history. Facing Islamophobia, Mamdani keeps focus on 9/11 victims. Here's another one. After 9/11, Islamophobia shaped a generation of Muslim New Yorkers. The Muslims are the victims here. That should have been clear for the last 25 years, right?
Yeah, I've written two columns about that. This, in fact, I think three columns this week, because there is this steady stream of stories out there that are focusing on Muslims who claim that they are the subject of great hate because of 9/11. And first of all, we know that's not true, because since 9/11, there are more Muslims today in New York City who came there or were born there after 9/11 than before 9/11. If New York City or America were a hellhole for Muslims, they wouldn't be all rushing to come here. And second of all, it's all about taking the focus away from the people who were victimized, and again, identifying a victim group out there who are not being victimized, who just fit into the DEI categories of the media. I call them the Pravda media and the left-wing establishment.
Yeah,
the same thing happened with October 7th. I mean, already by October 8th, you had two phenomena all at once. You had all these Muslims and in particular Palestinians celebrating what happened, the murder and rape and everything that took place in Israel. And you had protests out there calling Israel, you know, a perpetrator of genocide well before the war happened or anything else. You know, the perpetrators became the victims. And, you know, ever since in the media, when they talk about the victims in the Gaza war, most of whom are, you know, Hamas fighters, probably two out of every three, they're treated as victims. And most of them had been involved in October 7th or other terrorist attacks.
Well, let's go further than that. And you, I know you included this. You embedded this in one of your columns from earlier on hotair.com. But and this is something that doesn't get repeated very often. I don't even know if I saw it anywhere else this week. But there were Palestinians dancing in the streets, kids, moms, dads, celebrating the fact that the Twin Towers fell during that time period. So you can call it Islamophobia, or you can call it Muslims cheering on death of America, which still happens, by the way, within our own boundaries in Dearborn, Michigan, and other places right now. I'm sure certainly in New York City.
In New York City, Zohran Mamdani has many times gone and spoken at mosques where they explicitly talk about killing and murdering and eliminating Western society. You know, it's preached in mosques across the United States that it is the mission of Muslims in the United States to destroy Western society and replace it with Sharia law. I mean, that's not something, you know, that anyone has made up. You know, it happens every Friday, every Saturday in mosques where they tell people it is your duty to become a martyr and to, you know, kill the infidel.
Yeah. And these are even through the lens that we have this week with remembering 9/11, I don't think there's been nearly enough emphasis on that in, you know, some of the legacy media coverage, because it's still real and we're still at war with radical Islam. And I think we're very lucky that we haven't had anything, you know, of this level happen in this country since then. I think that surprises a lot of people, right?
Yeah, well, I have the perfect example of how absurd this is. The Economist magazine, which presents itself as a very centrist, very fact-centered magazine, actually wrote a piece about how we shouldn't worry about Islam. We should worry about Islamism. And then they go on to explain that 40 to 45% of Muslims believe that violence is acceptable to impose Islam and Sharia law. And it's like, well, if almost half the people who are Muslims also believe that, you know, terrorism is okay, I think you should be afraid of Islam. I mean, you know, are there Muslims who present no danger, who don't approve of this? Of course there are. But would you let mass immigration from a population, half of whom believe that violence is justified against you? You'd be an idiot to do so. And we're idiots because we're doing so.
It's insanity. It really is. And it's not even talked about enough, because even if you bring it up, you're Islamophobic, right?
Yeah, well, you're a racist, although Islam is not a race. And, you know, they're ignoring the fact that, I mean, when we talk about the separation of church and state, we look at religion and politics as two separate realities. But if you look at Islam, Islam is a totalitarian ideology, meaning that politics and ethics and morality and religion are all one unit. So when you talk about law, you're talking about Sharia law. That's not just, you know, law having to do with God's law. It's the law. You know, there is no understanding of the separation of church and state. And so when you're talking about whether Islam is a problem, you have to understand what Islam is. It's not like modern Christianity. It is a religion that is also a political movement, which is how and why. I mean, people talk about decolonization. There has been no religious movement that has been more about colonizing than Islam. It conquered Everywhere that Islam dominates, it conquered those territories. It was not spread through, people going, monks and priests going out and preaching the gospel. It was by the sword. And that's the fundamental understanding. The Eastern Roman Empire used to be based in what we now call Turkey, but it was the Roman Empire back then. And they were pushed out by the Turkish Muslim invaders that came in and knocked down the empire and eventually took Constantinople and completely changed the entire region. That is what Islam is. And they're not ashamed of it. I'm not saying anything that isn't what, your ordinary Muslim would say. That is what Islam is.
I'm with you, David Strom. I think everything you said there is 100% the truth. By the way, maybe I should have started this, but what are your specific 9/11 memories? Where were you when that happened 25 years ago today?
Well, I'll tell you, I was just at home ready to go to a meeting, and I was turning on the TV, but a lot of things went through my mind at the time. I was about to go in for heart surgery on the 20th of September 2001, and I was scared to death. I mean, I was terrified. Open heart surgery, and I watched this happen in front of my eyes, and I realized how I was so focused on myself, and I'm watching the world change before my eyes, and it actually put it into perspective.
Interesting.
For me. That I should worry less about myself.
That's an interesting perspective that you came away from. Obviously, the surgery was successful. I know you've had health challenges. Great columns this week, though, David. I really appreciated them. I'm glad we got a little bit of a discussion here about Lindsey Clancy. I see a breaking story now that they're digging into the background of the holdout juror, and that people are saying there's an NBC station in Boston saying he's got domestic violence, history. So now they're going after this guy, right? So it's not going to be about Lindsey Clancy. It's going to be about the holdout juror. We'll see how that plays out. David, have a great weekend. I appreciate you coming on this afternoon.
Absolutely.
All right. We got some further 9/11 memories. I mean, there's so many things that I could play, so much audio. I want to share a couple of the memories coming up next on 97.1 FM Talk. This is a singer-songwriter by the name of Stella Lefty. I like this song quite a bit. Her new album is just out. I like it. Everybody wants you, and it makes me I bring it up because she's playing the Confluence Music Festival over across the river as part of the Enjoy Illinois 300. So they have a lot of good artists over there. Old Dominion, Chris Jansen. Stella is one of the headliners, but she's blown up. She had this song, I think I've talked about her a couple of times, called Boston, that went completely viral. And my understanding is she's the heir. Who is it? It's her father is, I don't want to say the heir, she might have brothers and sisters too, but her father is the guy who came up with, I think, Groupon. So wealthy family. But music was not really in her plans. And then all of a sudden she started noodling around with a guitar and writing songs. And she's fantastic. So she's here this weekend in St. Louis. On a musical front, we're going to talk with Stephen Bishop's wife. Her name is Liz Camlett. And Liz is fascinating. She's a music business savant. I think she knows everything about the business aspect of music, and she helps her husband in that way as a manager. But some of the things that she posts on Instagram and she talks about are just fascinating. So she's coming up here. We have audio cut of the day as well. Just a couple of random things. I wanted to throw this in before I get to audio cut of the day. Sue, I know that you're not a big NFL fan, but last night's game was in, let me see if I can have you pronounce this. It was in Australia, okay? Uh-huh. It was not in Sydney, Australia. It was in another city that starts with an M. Would you like to tell me what that city is?
I have no idea.
Okay, it's spelled MELB. Oh, come on. You know the cities.
You
in
mean
Australia.
Melbourne?
Right. Okay, say it again.
Melbourne.
Okay, listen to this. This is Noah Eagle, who's the son, I think, of Ian, or Ian Eagle. It's not even Ian. It's Ian Eagle calling the play-by-play last night. This got on a lot of people's nerves. You ready?
San Francisco will have two timeouts and look to go 80 yards down the field, a double dip here in Melbourne. A beautiful scene for some football.
So he kept saying Melbourne over
that's
and over.
Not right.
Melbourne. Well, you know what? It's funny because there were people that were in Australia that were kind of defending it as that's how they say it.
That's how they say it.
So I wouldn't say Melbourne. That sounds too American. Right. I'd say Melbourne, something like that. Like, there'd still be an R in there, right?
Yeah, what? Let me hear. Oh, shoot.
Well, I'll let you hear it one more time. Right, he literally says Melbourne.
San Francisco will have two timeouts and look to go 80 yards down the field to double dip here in Melbourne.
And he would say
he
it over.
Say Melbourne.
No, but he said it over and over again because I think he was trying to say it like they say it. But let's face it. Let's take some issues here with our friends in Australia and across the pond in the UK. Because if you say the word lieutenant, there's no F in there, okay?
No.
But they say lieutenant, okay?
Well, that's
there's
just
no R in Cuba. Is there an R in Cuba?
No.
Well, that is pronounced Cuber. So these folks in Australia and England, we're not going to really take English language lessons and pronunciations from them because they put words in. Now, I know we got some weird stuff in our language too, but they put letters in where they don't belong and they take letters out where they do belong.
Well, that's true. I don't think we're letter adders quite as much. I mean, a little bit on the East Coast maybe, but maybe he's trying to do that thing. Like, what's the city that I'm trying to think of? It's not Nashville. Some people say Nashville, others say Nashville.
Oh, no, you're thinking
about.
Pennsylvania, there's what's the city in Pennsylvania? Because look, when I say, here's the deal. I've been to 15 Kentucky Derbies and a couple of Breeders' Cups in Louisville. My friend Joe Arnold Scott Jennings. There's another one though. I'll get to in a second.
Okay.
But I don't say Louisville.
No.
Okay, I say Louisville. When I say New Orleans, I say Narlands. I don't say New Orleans.
I'm sorry. Actually say Narlands.
I say Narlands. Okay. Well, that's how they say it down there.
I think that's not
letters or taking letters out.
But I think that's what sure it is. There's no W in Narlands.
Where is there a W in the way that I say it?
That's what I mean.
N-A-R-L-E-A-N-S.
Yes,
Narlands.
You're not pronouncing it.
I'm pronouncing it.
Where's the new?
You just don't like the, well, they don't say it that way down there.
Well, that's what he's doing. That's my point. So he's trying to be hip. It's annoying to those of us who don't.
No, but there's the city. Oh, my God. People are yelling at their radios right now. There's something in Pennsylvania where they get real particular if you say it one way versus the other, right?
I was thinking of Louisville or Louisville.
Well, Louisville is one of those because you can't say Louisville. You just sound stupid, right? It's Louisville. That's what they say.
Uh-huh.
And it's Narlands, right?
I am not going to say
Narlands.
Why won't
you say that? You don't say New Orleans, do you?
I would say New Orleans.
All right, we're going to have to agree to disagree on that front right there.
But
we can both agree that it's not Melbourne.
Yes, it is not Melbourne.
We're coming back. Liz Camlett, who is a fascinating music industry expert. She's the wife of artist Stephen Bishop. And this is Stella Lefty. She's here in St. Louis this weekend on Sunday across the river at the race. Ah, this is a little Stephen Bishop music. Used to play this on the radio a lot.
Down in Jamaica, they got lots of pretty.
I suppose it would be considered yacht rock. You know, I mentioned that documentary that came out a couple years ago. It was fantastic. And then over the summer, you might remember this, I talked about this yacht rock tribute album, if you will, that Keith Urban did. And it was right around that time, and I don't know how this happened, but I fell into a very fascinating Instagram feed of Stephen Bishop's wife, whose name is Liz Camlett, who's with us tonight to talk about the music business. She's written a book called Guard Your Publishing. She's got a fascinating Instagram feed. Liz, welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
I don't even know really how I found you, but once I found you for the first time, and I think you were kind of breaking down the different royalties, and I think you were maybe talking about Keith in that album, and as a music fan and as someone who used to work in the music business 40 years ago, I just became fascinated by what you do, so I thought it'd be a good opportunity to get a chance to know you. So before we get into what you do online and Instagram, just give me a little background of what your background is.
Oh my gosh, that's a long story. I don't think we have time for that.
Well, let's summarize it.
Okay, I'm from New York. I have 3 degrees. I have a bachelor's and 2 MBAs. And I started as a tour photographer and then a manager. And then I started working at labels. And then I met Stephen. And here we are 10 years later. And I've worked with pretty much everybody. I have a company doing social media management, marketing, tour management, and I've worked with everybody from Stephen, Jimmy Webb, the Eagles, Eric Clapton, Bill Collins, Kenny Loggins, literally everybody on the Yacht Rock.
That's awesome.
Over the last 10 years. And what's funny, you played On and On in the beginning. I hear that every single day of my life.
Well, one of the questions I was going to ask you is like, Liz is going to hit me up for royalties here based on what she talks about on Instagram.
I was thinking about that.
I know you are.
No, but let me play,
because listen, I got to tell you something. I did play Stephen on the radio because I'm pretty old, so I used to play his music. But let's play Keith Urban here because Keith did a great job with this Yacht Rock record that came out a couple of months ago. And again, that's where I kind of, you know, met you to a certain extent on social media. And one of the first, I guess, posts that I saw was you breaking down what happens when an artist like Keith Urban covers a song by someone like Stephen Bishop. And you kind of, what's interesting about what you do, Liz, is you break down the numbers, right? And you're very honest about the math here. So, for example, with the audience, kind of run through that and the benefits of having a cover song from Keith Urban. And then there's more to it if he plays it in concert, right?
Yes, yes. So what's funny is that that album, Keith contacted us almost a year prior to him releasing that. And he just calls us up and he's like, hey, Steve, you know, I'm going to be doing this. You know, what do you think? And he sent us a demo and Steve's like, oh, I love it. He doesn't need Steven's permission, but let's run through it. Anyone can cover a song. The song has to be released first by the original artist for anyone to cover it. You have to get a cover license. Now, Steven owns 100% of the publishing. So let's say that song, Keith's version, which is the master version, which is the vocal, there's master and publishing. Let's say they wanted to use that in a film, TV, commercial. They have to go to Steven. And if Steven says no, nothing happens.
Right.
But Keith puts out an album and he has to pay a certain amount to Steven to license it. You know, it's anywhere between 9 and 12 cents based on if it's a record, if it's digital, if it's Apple, different download percentages. And Steven gets that amount. If it's charts, he gets even more money, which is really nice. So Keith gets the master. He gets the physical album sales, but Steven gets the publishing, which is the back end. And when Keith performs anywhere in the world, Steven gets paid in his pajamas or when he's asleep.
And that's the part that kind of fascinated me. And I think when you were talking about that, is that something that's covered by the venues with their BMI fees or their ASCAP fees, or is that something separate?
Yes, it's something called blanket licensing. So ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, every single venue in the world has to pay blanket licensing fees. It's anywhere from $1 a day to thousands of dollars a day based on the size of the venue. And some people are like, oh, no, I feel bad for the venue. I'm like, no, every venue knows you have to pay. So what happens? Let's say Keith performs in an arena. I actually can give you real numbers.
Yeah.
So, you know, Phil Collins had a number one hit with Stephen's song, Separate Lives, 100% publisher. And so Keith plays about the same size venues as Phil. So Stephen would get $5,000 to $10,000 every time Phil would perform that song. Every time, every night, which is crazy.
Yeah, and that adds up, right? It really does. And, you know, you kind of are really, really good at breaking some of these things down. Yesterday, I watched one of the posts that you made about, you know, whether an artist, a lot of independent artists, I'm friends with a lot of people who travel across the country. They play in smaller venues, Liz, you know, 350, 400, whatever. But you were talking about how it would be for an artist to go out on their own and try to rent a venue. And you broke down the cost. And there's not a lot of margin there for profit when you start, you know, throwing travel and all this other stuff in the mix, right?
Yes, I've been doing that for a few years now, and man, that video took off. I did not expect it to take off. I guess people don't realize how much goes into it. And, you know, when Steven goes out on the road, he gets a guarantee. His agency pitches Steven to everybody, and the venues are like, okay, we can give Steven this much money, plus flights, plus hotel, plus this to cover everything most of the time. Mm-hmm. But if you're an independent artist, we actually are renting one venue in San Diego, which is Steven's hometown, because the venue didn't believe Steven could sell in his hometown. I'm like, are you serious? So whatever. We had, you know, now we're dealing with Live Nation and Ticketmaster. Mm-hmm. The fees are insane. You got to do deposits. You have to do insurance. You have to do ASL, you have people who are hard of hearing. There's so many things. Security,
all that stuff.
Light,
wow.
Per diem, food, you know, also liability insurance. If someone sues you, it's over.
So, Liz, one of the stories, I like this story too, and I don't think you can say names, but you said that you were talking to a friend who might not be a friend anymore of an artist that had a song, and a big artist wanted to cover that song, and the wife kind of ran interference and didn't even help the artist that, right?
Mm-hmm. That bothers me so much. That's a real story. And it's just like, it blew my mind. Huge artist doing arenas. They just announced an arena tour, just saying. And, you know, this artist wanted to cover a song from the 60s. I'm like, oh my God, this is it. You're winning the lottery here.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, it's not such a huge song. And sure, the artist can still record and put it out. He doesn't need permission. He just has to get a cover license. But literally the artist said, hey, I just want your blessing. Like, common courtesy. Like, how nice is that?
Right.
Even like approach them and give them a demo. And she didn't even tell the artist that, no, it's really going to overshadow the original. Don't do it. And I'm thinking to myself, that is really stupid, because you're going to be paying your kids, your grandkids, grandkids, grandkids times 10 bills for the rest of your life. What are you doing? It's crazy.
I was baffled by that. I really was. Liz Camlett is here. We're talking about the music industry. You know, you were talking about publishing, and I want you to kind of explore that a little bit, because one of the things that's happening, as you know, is you got big artists out there that are selling their catalogs for hundreds of millions of dollars. And once that happens, they don't have control of that, right?
Nope, it's over. A really good example of that is Paul Anka. You know, Paul Anka is a legend, but he wrote a lot of songs, especially a really big one for Frank Sinatra, My Way. And when I knew it was over for that, for Frank, would be rolling over in his grave, I'm a big Frank Sinatra fan, there was a commercial about, how do I say this? It was a colonoscopy commercial.
Really?
You know? And they kept, for 3 years, it was about, you know what, literally putting something in a box and shipping it off to get tested.
I know the product. Yes, I know the product, right.
And I'm like, he has no control over it. But here's the thing. A lot of these artists are selling for 20 multiples. So let's say your catalog is making $100,000 a year. Let's break it down, right?
Okay.
Most multiples are between 14 and 20, 22, maybe 25, 26 if you're Bob Dylan. Let me talk about Bob Dylan in a second. But let's say your catalog is making $100,000 a year. They're going to give you, let's say, an advance of 15. So they're going to offer you $1.5 million forever. That means you give it away, but publishing, you actually have to pay a certain tax. It's 20% right off the top, plus additional taxes, plus everything. Let's say you're left with $1 million. Now, if you invest that, catalogs are going up 15% every year. I'm just going to do the math here. If you invest $1 million at the average of 5%, my dad's a financial advisor and business manager, so he taught me this.
Yeah.
If you're at an average of 5%, you're only making $50,000 a year. So you lose 50 grand a year by not keeping your catalog. But let's say you're Bob Dylan, right? This is really interesting. Any song that's pre-1976, it's 95 years from the date of publication, the date that you wrote the song. Anything after 1976 is life
public
of the composer.
Domain, right?
Yeah, for public domain. But after 76, it's life of the composer plus 70 years. So let's say Bob did all of his hits after 76 and he's still alive, right? Let's say he lived another 10, 15 years. That means the copyright, the public domain, it wouldn't be for another 90 years.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You give up on a 15 multiple, you know? But here's the thing with Bob Dylan. His songs are very early 60s. So he has about 32 to 33 years left for public domain. I think he sold for about a 26. So the company who bought it only has 6 years to profit on it. Smart.
Wow, that's interesting. Liz, how much does an artist, I mentioned, I know a lot of these, you know, smaller artists, but they have following, some of them even, you know, travel internationally. My sense is, and I don't get into the business aspect with them, that, you know, they got a tour to make money, they have to sell merch. But when it comes to streaming, you know, I grew up in a era where we bought records and then CDs. And I hear CDs are actually making a comeback. But when it comes to streams, I mean, you get 1 million streams on a song, that's still not a lot of money, right?
It depends on your deal. So the average, right, is about $3,000 what you get. But here's a really good trick if people want to know actually how much people are making. So the average is 0.001 to 0.006. Unfortunately, most independent artists are getting on the lower end, the 0.001. The bigger artists are getting 0.004, 0.005, which is about $4,000 to $5,000 per million stream. But let's say you see an artist online and they have 5 million monthly listeners, right? You double the amount of listeners, and that's how many streams they're getting per month.
Good math there. This is helpful.
Yes.
Liz Camlett. Yes. Well, thank you so much for coming on here. I seriously have been just completely, you're taking up a lot of my time because I'm watching your Instagram posts and I can't turn them off. And I've just become a big fan. Let's bring Stephen Bishop here to St. Louis. Bring him back. Liz, come on.
We're actually thinking of doing a St. Louis. I swear to God, I was having this conversation last week with our agent. We are thinking of doing a show in St. Louis, and if we are, we will stop by.
Will you get in touch? Because really, I'd love it, and I'm just fascinated by what you do. So is it, just give the, I know I follow you, but give your handle out for people who want to follow.
Oh, it's Liz Kamlett. It's LizKamlett. Or just, you know, Google Liz, the music manager, on Instagram and TikTok.
And for those people, I would suggest this to my artist friends, any musicians listening, the book Guard Your Publishing is something people should check into, yeah. Right, Liz?
Yeah, I spent about, technically I spent 10 years putting it together. And it's Guard Your Publishing. It's everything you need to know about the music business. It really breaks down real world topics. And I think a lot of independent artists will find value in the resources. And it really does give you how to, like, step by step.
Fascinating stuff. Liz, thank you so much. I hope to see you here in St. Louis. I appreciate it.
Of course. You have a great day.
All right. Big game in Lawrence, Kansas tonight. The Jayhawks against the Tigers. And shamefully, the alums of the University of Kansas and their football program itself have put out a video, a hype video, that actually makes race a part of this game tonight. It's really shameful. It's embarrassing. First of all, I'd say if you're a Mizzou alum or parent who sent your kids to KU, shame on you. You should have parenting rights taken away. But look, on a serious front, it's a great rivalry. This is a football game tonight. And if you don't know what KU did with this video, you should go on my Twitter and find it and look at some of the comments, because honestly, these KU fans are trying to make this about race. Pat Ford, who used to be on ESPN, he's a great Mizzou alum, said, when the opportunity arises to manipulate a 106-year-old tragic history and apply it to college football in 2026, associating one team with slavery and the Confederacy in the process, you probably shouldn't. This is crap. And it is crap. TJ Moe even pointed out, you know, to demonstrate how dumb this is, because the Jayhawkers were, it was a militia, it was an anti-slavery militia, right? Well, the Missouri Tigers, the Tigers are actually named after the Union-aligned militia called the Missouri Tigers that also stepped up to defend Columbia from the Confederate guerrilla raids. So to make this about slavery in any way, shape, or form is just idiotic. And I hope we win this game by 4 touchdowns to shut these ridiculous KU fans up.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Well, this is from the Pentagon this morning. Ceremonies all over the country, but obviously in New York City, the Pentagon, and in Pennsylvania, where Flight 93 crashed. You had a lot of different people that were, you know, speaking at these ceremonies today. And, you know, I was really taken this week just by some of the people that have told their stories in the aftermath of this. Some of these kids who weren't even born, maybe their moms were pregnant and their fathers died in the you know, buildings that day. But here in New York City, you know what, they do this, and it took hours and hours to read the names of the victims.
Gregory Allen Clark.
Manny Leroy Clark.
Sarah M. Clark.
Something else they did today, Sue, is they read the names of thousands of people who have died to related illnesses, you know, that are connected with 9/11.
And wow.
It's just sad. So many people have died because of that as well.
And my brother, Joseph Michael Giacconi. The pain is still there. The void in my family will never be completely healed. The what could have been and should have been still make me angry. He should have been holding his two beautiful grandchildren right now. But Joe, Sandra did a good job. And this ceremony is essential. At the very least, I get to come here one day a year and speak my brother's name, Joseph Michael Giacconi, out loud. And you hear it. And he is here, and he is present, and he is never forgotten. We love you and miss you.
Yeah, there were so many of those today, gosh. And that was certainly one of the highlights. And I hope people take some time and watch some of the great documentaries out there. There's some stuff on YouTube. It's just so sad. And like I said several times this week, this one's hitting me a lot harder than the other anniversaries. Sue, have a great weekend.
You too.
Talk on Monday afternoon.
Get more at 971talk.com.